Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
Less than 8 months after a stretch of historic and deadly wildfire in the Pacific Northwest, we find ourselves staring down the barrel of another potentially catastrophic fire season. Over the course of several weeks, we're going beyond the headlines to look at the danger ahead this summer, how you can be better prepared for the worst-case scenario, and if there needs to be a fundamental change in the way we approach wildfire. We start our conversation with fire weather expert John Saltenberger from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center. He takes us into the history and future of forecasting fire danger, and we discuss if the time has come to treat wildfire more like other natural disasters. I'm Ian Costello. It is Tuesday, April 20th. And you are listening to Beyond the Headlines on the Coin Podcast Network. John, when did this fire weather science start? What events were there in history that led somebody to say, hey, we really need to be paying attention to this?
That's a good question. And that's one of the elements that I teach in advanced fire behavior training every 2 years at the National Fire Academy. So the answer to your question is that there has been looking at fire weather contributions to fire outbreaks in the United States and elsewhere in the world since about 1900, 1910. So it's going on over 100 years now that fire scientists and then the fledgling science of meteorology started to get together and look for common contributing factors that were present during historic fire outbreaks. I think of the 1910 historic fire outbreak in the Northern Rockies. And
the big blow up.
Yeah, the big fire. That's when things really started kicking into gear. There was interest in the years prior to World War II with the Tillamook fires in Oregon. There was a series of Tillamook fires actually over several years. And so there was looks at that. Research scientists put together common patterns, usually associated with the passage of weather fronts, like cold fronts moving through and commensurate increase in winds when those. But that wasn't the whole story. Following World War II, when there was suddenly a lot more availability to research the upper atmosphere with more powerful aircraft and an expanded network of worldwide weather balloon probes of the upper atmosphere that were routine rather than ad hoc. When that started happening, then research scientists were able to start looking at not only the conditions near the surface of the Earth, winds, temperatures, and humidities, but they started to look at the vertical profile of the atmosphere, particularly as it related to temperature lapse rates or what's called stability in the atmosphere. And they also looked at configurations and orientations of the jet stream and found that indeed, even though the jet stream is typically confined to the upper atmosphere, 20 to 25,000 or more feet up in the atmosphere, the contortions that the jet stream goes through can have an influence on the movement of surface weather patterns and have an influence on wildland fire growth. So there was an explosion of research potential following World War II with the implementation of global weather balloon networks.
What drove your interest and involvement in it?
As a high school student in California in the late 1970s, I oftentimes spent my summers camping in the mountains of Northern California. Over those summers, I became acquainted with a number of U.S. Forest Service Rangers who patrolled campgrounds and did fire patrol in the vicinity of the places where I camped. And I can remember one dramatic year, I think it might have been about 1977 or 1978, when all those U.S. Forest Service Rangers suddenly disappeared one day. And we were puzzled where they went. And we found out later that they had been called to a big fire in the Yolaboli Wilderness in Northern California. And they were gone for weeks to combat that fire. At that time, as a young man, I was interested in weather. And I was also interested in aviation. And I was also interested in, then I became interested in fire, realizing that sometimes massive efforts had to be made to contain large wildfire outbreaks. From that, I elected to go to school in meteorology. And then from that, when I graduated in 1986, I was assigned to a weather office working for the National Weather Service that specialized in fire support for state and federal wildland fire managers in two terms, in wildfire suppression and also in prescribed fire management as well. I knew from the first week on the job what I wanted to do for the rest of my career. And that was 36 years ago.
You mentioned growing up in California. I want to bring it into 2020, 2021 here. We're seeing these reports out of California over the last couple of days, specifically making reference to plant moisture content. And there are some dire predictions coming along with it. Overall, how does the preceding winter dictate the following fire season?
So there are several schools of thought about that, and I haven't really seen it backed up by any consistent research in any one geographic area of the country, and that includes the Pacific Northwest. The schools of thought hold that if we get a wet winter, then we see grass growth in the following spring from the moisture, and therefore we have a big buildup of fuel, and the potential for wildland fire is high. The other school of thought says that, well, if we have a dry winter, things will dry out earlier in the spring and the summer, and we're going to have a heck of a fire season because things have dried out. As far as any objective research that has investigated the relationship between what a preceding winter and a spring precip is like and then what the following fire season is like, I haven't seen it. I would only add from my own, again, subjective experience in forecasting in Oregon for the last 30 years is that what I have found is the most important contributing factor is the weather during the fire season. I have seen fire seasons where we had plenty of moisture and a heavy winter prior to the fire season, but by August, there was lots of fire burning around the region. On the other hand, I've seen years where we had relatively light precip and a kind of a dry summer, but if conditions don't line up right, it wasn't a particularly busy season. So the combination of contributing factors, mainly weather and fire danger during the fire season, that I have found to be the most important contributors.
No matter what happens in an individual winter, whether it be last winter or working back a couple of winters, the idea of the prolonged drought on the West Coast, up and down the West Coast, is definitely making things more dangerous, more volatile, regardless of what happens during the winter.
Yes, there is certainly a carryover effect for a series of dry winters. You can't help but accumulate drought debt over time, and that can't help but contribute to stressing vegetation, dead vegetation and live vegetation as well, weakening it, making it more susceptible to bug kill, making it more susceptible to fire, that under other circumstances, it might normally have been able to survive. So yeah, I think there's little doubt that the cumulative effect of a number of years of drought are going to play in. One of the things that I have paid attention to in the last few years is a publication that I saw from, I believe it's from the U.S. Forest Service working with the University of Montana, that showed that over many sections of the western United States, the number of rainy days during fire season have dramatically decreased over the last four decades, something like 40%. So the lack of precipitation during fire season that would give us periodic resets and fire danger, we're not getting those resets as frequently as we used to. And therefore, fire danger climbs and there's just nothing to hold it back day by day. And therefore, we have a more volatile situation showing up. The pattern is ominous.
Take me through the next several weeks, maybe all the way to the 1st of July. If I said blank would really concern you, you would say what?
I would say that if I saw continued drought and early drying of fuels and loss of snowpack over the Pacific Northwest in our mid and high elevations, two things would concern me: early and severe drying, and then more importantly, and multiple ignition sources from human beings on holiday weekends or lightning. Simply having dry forests is not necessarily a sufficient condition to guarantee that we're going to have a busy fire season. What really eats our lunch is having dry conditions set up first and foremost to set the stage, and then having multiple ignitions, such as from a lightning storm or from an arsonist or from careless campers, give us more ignitions in a short period of time than initial attack firefighters can handle in that short period of time. And then we're in a world of trouble because the potential for getting large cost fires ramps up considerably when there are multiple ignitions in a short period of time.
I've been covering deadly wildfires my entire career, but it seems to be increasing. Are catastrophic fire seasons the rule now rather than the exception?
Like you pointed out, every year or every other year or every third year, we're breaking records in terms of acreage burned or numbers of fires on the landscape or dollars spent in suppression or homes lost. That has certainly been on an upward trend. There's just no denying it. The figures are showing that. And that is true across much of the Western United States, where there's a steady upward ramp in the resources expended, acres burned, and resource value lost. So that's why I say ominous. It's headed in an ominous direction.
Do we need to start treating wildfires like other deadly natural disasters? People hopefully evacuate before hurricanes hit. Tornado sirens send people hopefully into shelters. And hopefully when it comes to earthquakes, people have kits. John, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think people treat a red flag warning with the same kind of respect.
I'm drawn to my experiences forecasting in Australia about 12 or 13 years ago, following the Black Saturday fires in the state of Victoria in Southeast Australia. I was there for that, and it was a tremendous catastrophic event. Temperatures of 115 degrees with 30 to 40 mile per hour winds sweeping across the state of Victoria and down power lines and other accidents resulted in ignition of catastrophic fires, and 170 people lost their lives and multiple communities were damaged. In the aftermath of the fires, the Black Saturday fires in Victoria, the Australian government convened what's called a Royal Commission to study the problem and make recommendations about preventative measures to reduce risk in the future. One of the outcomes of the Royal Commission's study was to add a fourth or a fifth category of fire threat on top of their existing fire danger rating scale to highlight those conditions, which are really right at the top of the scale. And the Black Saturday fires were. The National Weather Service, who's responsible for issuing red flag warnings, has gone the route of, believe it or not only hiring more scientists to do research, they are also working with social scientists as well to help better formulate messages toward spurring action on the part of the recipients of things like warnings for high fire threat. They're also fundamentally rethinking about how advisories such as red flag warnings are going to be issued and named and delivered in the future. Since I don't work for the Weather Service any longer, I'm only in passing familiarity with some of the plans that they have in place. From what I have been able to gather is that they are considering something similar to issuing red flag warnings on a par with, say, like hurricane warnings, categorizing them with different rating levels as for seriousness. I think that's a good idea. If it brings more research firepower to bear on a developing problem, I can't help but think that that's anything but good. The presence of the social scientist means that not only will the information be calculated scientifically, but delivered in a way that decision makers can take easier action on.
As fire weather science moves forward and fire weather warnings maybe evolve a little bit, is there a scenario you can see where pre-evacuation would make any sense at all?
I do know that Australia, again, I go back to my experiences there, is that they do have such procedures in place in the fire-prone states of Australia, where when fire warnings are issued, the state and local governments take positive action, which includes advising homeowners and property owners to either evacuate or to go to rallying grounds in communities like soccer fields and open spaces and whatnot. On the other hand, the option is open for some residents to stay and defend their property themselves. And they're equipped and trained in how to do that and to do some defense of their property and also take evasive action should they need to. Up to and including, there are folks in Australia who have underground shelters similar to tornado shelters here in the United States that they will retreat to in the event of a catastrophic fire blow over.
Obviously, you're on the science side and there's the decision makers on the decision making side. That relationship, though, when you talk about policy, whether it's pre-evacuation, whether it's requiring power companies to shut down high-density lines, whether it's rerouting train traffic, closing wilderness roads, all of that kind of stuff are policy decisions. Do you feel, as a scientist, the people who are making the policy decisions are listening to the science?
My experience here at NWC is just working in dispatch of firefighting resources around Oregon and Washington, mainly federal, but occasionally involved with the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. My position here and the unit that I work in here at NWC, our specific purpose is to first analyze the fire load across the Pacific Northwest and the commitment of firefighting resources and evaluate that in real time every single day during fire season. And then we also try to project forward in time, say out to 10 days in the future, how will our fire load change? How will our workforce requirements change over the next 10 days as the fire danger and fire weather patterns fluctuate existing fires may come off the board as fire crews finish their job, but new ones will come on the board as we get an incidence of lightning over a dry forest. When we're confident that we see an optimum combination of high fire danger, critical fire weather, and ignition sources all coming together at the same time in the same place, managers here at the Northwest Coordination Center, representing the federal and state wildland fire agencies in the Pacific Northwest, will take proactive action. That means ordering up fire crews, ordering up aircraft and helicopters, fire engines, and all the support apparatus, and strategically pre-placing them in places where we think the threat is highest so that we can minimize travel time to incidents that break out as a result of a new fire start under critical conditions. We use a probabilistic model that helps us game out the threat of areas where new large fires are likely to break out, and we act on that.
What's the hardest part about your job?
Sometimes you have to tell people information they don't want to hear. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to face fire managers and tell them, I know that we already have a serious fire situation in place in Oregon and Washington, and all our firefighting resources are committed. And I have to tell you, we had a new lightning storm coming our way over the next couple of days. It looks like it's going to put down several hundred lightning strikes and probably give us scores of new fires. Sometimes when I am tasked with giving unhappy information like that, there's some pushback. People want to know, how confident are you in your projections? There's a good chance this won't happen. One of the things that I have done in my career as a forecaster is to develop my scientific skills, which included becoming a best meteorologist I could possibly become, and going back to school and taking training in fire science, firefighting, and fire behavior and fire danger as well. I was able to learn the language of wildland firefighters, particularly decision makers who have to make the difficult decisions about distribution of firefighting resources around the region or prioritizing distribution of firefighting resources. The better I was at speaking their language and understanding that the pressures and threats that they were facing, the more finely tuned I could take the information that I was presenting and tailor it to exactly answer the question that they were asking. But in the end, I have to sometimes hang my professional reputation out on a limb because I'm looking at the fluctuation of weather patterns and fire danger, and those aren't always 100% predictable as we'd like them to be.
I'm curious, where does the science go from here? What's left to learn about fire weather?
So last week, about this time, I was participating in a fire weather webinar seminar put on by San Jose State University that's specifically focused on fire weather and its trends in new science and technology. And one of the consistent themes that came out of that webinar that I participated in was that a new trend in the science of fire weather and fire behavior is coupled atmospheric fire models. Right now, the fire models that we run simply run based upon weather conditions at the surface of the earth, winds, temperature, and humidity. And it doesn't have any mathematical relationship to what's going on with fire in the third dimension. The new suite of fire behavior models that are much more computationally intensive are going to start taking into account how the fire itself will influence the weather pattern at the surface. Right now, they're handled separately. The new generation of fire behavior models look like they're going to take into account both at the same time and how there's a mutual feedback between the two. And that's pretty impressive.
What do you wish people understood better about fire weather?
When I traveled to Australia back in 2008, during the flight across the ocean, I listened to the flight attendants working in the galley, and I was astonished to hear folks who weren't even involved in day-to-day wildland fire suppression. These are flight attendants on an airliner talking about how the fire danger indices were going to fluctuate day-to-day about the time that we arrived in Melbourne, that the common citizens were as familiar with day-to-day fluctuations in fire danger as fire managers are here in the United States. They were speaking the same lingo. They were looking at the digital of fluctuations in winds, temperatures, and humidities, and the resultant threat across key points across the state of Australia. I was utterly amazed and impressed at the familiarity of fire threat as it changed day by day in Australia amongst common citizens.
Are those lessons learned through loss? They know those things because they have to know those things.
Yeah, I think that's true. They've had bitter experience with deadly, costly, catastrophic wildfires roughly every decade or so. I think hard experience has taught them to be fire aware, and they do so. And it was positively a pleasure to work not only with the wildland fire community in Australia, the meteorological community as well, but also their news media. It was very savvy when it came to tracking day-to-day fluctuations in fire danger.
Do you think that's a lesson that people in the Pacific Northwest are going to have to learn eventually?
I think so.
We're going to have to pay more attention to what fire weather is telling us.
I think so. You know, if this trend of increasingly dry summers continues, even if nothing else changes, just the fact that we seem to be having increasingly dry summers without periodic periods of rain, practically guarantee that our fire load is going to get bigger and bigger year by year, unless something changes that I can't see, unless there's some kind of trend coming that's going to reverse things. And I would certainly hope that that's the case, but I'm just based upon the trend that we're seeing, the fire load does seem to be worsening. And therefore, I suspect that our policymakers, our decision makers, are going to have to be faced with hard decisions about how we distribute firefighting resources, how we prep communities for fire threat as we get into fire season. And that's all going to require greater and greater daily awareness of how fire danger fluctuates.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Just a reminder, the COIN Podcast Network is dedicated to bringing you comprehensive coverage of this fire season. Check out the Your Weather podcast each week as meteorologists Kelly Barron and Joseph Dames track current conditions and bring you fire weather updates. Plus, look for special continued coverage of wildfire season anytime, all across the COIN Podcast Network. You can find it on coin.com/podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Thank you for listening to the COIN Podcast Network. We will talk to you soon.
Hello, COIN 6 News anchor Emily Burris here. We know your mornings are busy, and we want to help you be in the know as you head out the door. That's why the COIN Podcast Network is bringing you a brand new podcast called The Daily Six. Every weekday, we'll bring you the day's six biggest headlines in a quick and concise report, on demand and on your schedule. So check out the COIN Podcast Network on coin.com or have the Daily Six sent directly to you each day by subscribing to the COIN Podcast Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.